Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
So we are in our Death's Door message series. And this morning to start, I want you to think of when you were a kid, like a little kid, and you were very aware of how big the world was around you and how small you were. You might have had this thing, this object, something in your life that you thought, when I'm big enough to do this, when I'm adult enough, when I'm as tall as maybe you had an older brother or a sibling, or you looked at your parents, when I'm big enough to do this, then I will have arrived. Then I will be like a real grown adult. See, for me in our house, I loved juice. Water, like any kind of beverage growing up, was my favorite thing ever. And the ability to access juice at any time I wanted to was probably like my highest goal in life. That was my aim. And maybe strategically, you can tell me later, Mom, but in the corner cabinet, we had all of our cups. And it was always just out of reach. Like, I just couldn't get up there. And sometimes, like, we didn't have, my house is like, we trip over stools all the time for my 4-year-old and 6-year-old, so they have a layup error. But we didn't have those kinds of stools in the kitchen. It was like just maneuvering on the handles to get up onto the shelf so you can open the door and get the cup and go get the juice yourself. And I remember vividly thinking, one day, I will be so big, I won't have to climb on the shelf, on the counter anymore. I won't have to feel that cold, cold formica. Was it kind of like a, yeah, that cold formica on my knees. I will just be able to walk up like an adult and open the cupboard and get a cup for myself. And it's fascinating. I mean, I don't want to brag, but I've arrived. On the regular, I get my own glasses. But it's funny, when you're in that space, when you get there, there's this weird part of me that every once in a while is like, gosh, wouldn't it be so great if I was too small to get a cup and like someone had to come get the cup for me, right? They'd like, I'd just go sit at the table and they'd bring me juice like I do literally every single morning for my boys. It's this funny thing about growing up. It's this funny thing about how we see ourselves as children. We usually have this thing we're reaching for in adulthood. And it's this kind of moving target that we're always moving toward. I'll be old enough to move out of the house. I'll be old enough to drive. I'll be old enough to do whatever it is. And then when we get there, there can be satisfaction, celebration, but there's usually this, I yearn for the days when I was in kindergarten and it was coloring books and naps. Like, oh, to have a nap during the day again. Like, that would be the life. This morning, we want to look at and explore that concept because Jesus is using that idea and that concept to invite us into a very specific kind of mourning. And the reason why we're going through this message series, Death's Door, is it's really an invitation to mourn. It's something that's it's a bit of a lost art for us here in the West. It's a bit of a lost art in the United States. We tend to avoid mourning. We don't step into it. And as we're going to talk about this morning, we tend to only mourn certain things. Whereas mourning is a way bigger concept. It's not just to be sad about the good things we no longer have. It's to mourn and the loss of all kinds of things. That something has changed, something's different, something that we thought would happen in the future, whether good or bad, isn't happening anymore. How do we step into that space? Because until we do that, it is a weight we carry with us. We don't quite carry it forward. So we're looking at, in this whole series, we're looking in the book of Mark. So if you have your Bible with you, if you have it on an app on your phone, great, pull it up. If you don't, that's okay. We'll have it up on the screen. We'll walk through it. But we're looking at Mark 8 last week. This week, we're looking in Mark 9. And next week, we're looking in Mark 10. And the reason for this is in 8, 9, and 10, three times Jesus says, hey, I'm going to die. And so we want to look at what do the stories before and Jesus saying this, and after, what do they illustrate about death and mourning? What is Jesus trying to prepare his disciples for? Because if we step into that space, we can also see what is Jesus preparing us for today in the same way. All right, let's get into the story. We're going to start in Mark 9, 15 to 18. And just a little bit of context for you. In Mark 9, directly before the section we're going to look at, Jesus just took Peter, James, and John, three of his closest disciples, up to this mountainside. And it's this moment called the Transfiguration, where Jesus' very appearance changes. And it's like the thing that happened in Mark 8 when Peter said, hey, you're the Messiah, you're the leader. It became like a visual representation of that happened with these disciples where they said, whoa, there is something different and special going on here. And he appears with the heroes of Jewish old, and they immediately recognize him. It's this big, grand moment. So Jesus comes back from that moment with his disciples, and it says here, what are you arguing with them about? These are the words of Jesus when he gets back down. A man in the crowd answered, teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him on the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. And to skip ahead, we're going to jump into verse 22 here. It says, but if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. These are the words of the Father to Jesus. And Jesus says, if you can, said Jesus, everything is possible for the one who believes. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. Now, this line, I love it. It's one of my favorite passages in Scripture. We actually looked at it a couple of weeks ago, so hopefully it sounds familiar to some of you. What's going on is Jesus comes down from this pretty incredible experience. His followers are arguing with some teachers of the law. They're called the scribes in the story. And they're having this argument while this father stands by, just wanting healing for his son. So to think for a second of this father, if you yourself or people you know have ever gone through any kind of medical crisis, there's ever been any really hard prognosis given to them, any really hard medical diagnosis given to them, you know that there's kind of a path that you walk. You don't tend to start at the very beginning with going to a miracle healer. We tend to start with, well, what does the doctor say? Whoever gave me this diagnosis, what do we do? And you try a medication, you try a surgery, you try something. And if that fails, then, well, what's plan B? And then we move on through this cycle. By the time you get to the miracle healer, we're at plan like T through Z. Do you know what I mean? This isn't the first step. And there's something interesting if you've been in these kinds of spaces. When you start praying for something, when you start wanting something to be fixed, either physical, spiritual, emotional, there's a hope in that the first thing will give you an answer. And when the first step, if it doesn't work, that hope doesn't go away. That hope is wounded and harmed, but it stays with you and it rolls into the next option and picks up a little bit more hope. And if that fails, the hope rolls on to the next thing. It starts to become this bigger and bigger cascading wave where more and more hope gets put on the future. So imagine this man who's at one of his last options is sitting there, and he has to listen to these disciples of Jesus, the ones that should be able to do healing, have done miraculous healing for others in the community, and he has to listen to them argue with some teachers of the law. How frustrating is that? How overwhelming is that experience? And when he says, look, if you can do anything, like have pity on us. And at first read, it can seem when Jesus says, if I can, it can read a bit like the equivalent of, do you know who I am, right? Do you know me? It could be seen and interpreted as a shaming statement. You don't know who you're talking to, man. I don't think that's what Jesus is doing at all. The primary reason is that would be entirely inconsistent with everything else Jesus has said and done. What is consistent with things that Jesus has said and done is when he's with his disciples and there's these moments happening, he tends to take the person who is seen in the story as the outsider and he brings them central and he makes them the community and the group's teacher. We're going to look more at how this story kind of resolves itself and how it ends. But there's something so significant about putting on display, does this man have belief? Does this man have faith? Because it's a lesson that the disciples need to learn. It's a lesson that they have to follow up on. So one of the things that I want to do in looking at this, because it's going to kind of carry, is if you see, all right, they came from the transfiguration. What is Jesus experiencing in this moment? What are the disciples experiencing in this moment? And what's the father of the boy? And so I invite you to add to this list to write down, but these were some of the thoughts that came to me. I think Jesus is exasperated. It actually reminds me a lot of another story in the Bible. If you know the story of Moses and the Ten Commandments, or if you're a big Charlton Heston fan, you know that he goes up on the mountainside. He has this experience with God, and in that story, it says that Moses' countenance, his face changes. There's this aura of light. He actually has to start wearing a veil because it's this overwhelming power and light to the community. So he has this literal mountaintop experience with God, comes down, and he's been gone, you know, for a while, and all the rest of the people have melted all the gold from their personal possessions and are worshiping a golden calf that they created. And Moses is like, are you kidding me? Throws down the Ten Commandments that he just came down with, and he goes back up and gets another set. I think this is the experience of Jesus. We just had the transfiguration. We just had this amazing experience. You come down, and we're fighting about who can heal and who has the power. And seeing this man's life and his experience with his child who is sick. He is desperate and will do anything. The hope has been rolling to solution after failed solution after failed solution. And you're fighting over that? I think Jesus is done in a lot of ways. I think he's frustrated. I think he's tired of this type of experience. I think the disciples who have been there and tried to do it, I think they're pretty humiliated. I think they feel impotent. See, as being followers of Jesus, before this point, we know that this healing that Jesus has been able to do of people who are blind, of people who can't walk, people that have leprosy, this has also been reflected in his followers. His followers who have been able to do healings as well, and here they're not able to do it. That's gotta feel really defeating. I mean, people have picked up house and home to come to you as their final solution, and you said the words, you did the thing that worked last time, and it didn't work. What do you do with that? I know if I was in that spot, I would feel pretty ashamed. I'd feel like this small, reaching for a sippy cup from the counter. I'd want to go hang off on the side. And I think the father of the boy is desperate. He just wants answers. He's not interested in their fighting and their sorting. He's not interested in people's agendas. I don't think he particularly cares about how hurt the disciples' feelings are at their ability not to do it. He just wants healing. And the reason why I think Jesus uses this character as the central teacher is everybody else in the story is posturing. Everybody else is so buried in their own shame that they can't come to grips with what's going on. But if you've ever been around someone who is desperate, it's the most honest person in the room. They've lost the ability to fake it. They've lost the ability to try and appear like something other than they are because it's all gone. All the other emotional energy is gone. If you ever watch those space movies, right, where they're going through the asteroid field and they've been hit and their shield gets down, at the end, there's just no shield left. That's this man. All the energy from the spaceship is just going to making it fly and have him show up in that moment and be there. He has no other energy for anything else. So who should we listen to in the story? That guy. That person. It's also a good lesson for us. The people that in grieving or in mourning or people in desperation that we tend to turn away from, Jesus is saying, that might be the place you want to go. That might be the kind of people you want to hang out with and be around and listen when they speak. They might be the only real people that you meet in your life. So we have all these emotions. We have all these different feelings, these different things going on. And then in Mark 9, 32 through 34, it says this. Jesus is talking to him later, and he says, they will kill him, speaking of himself, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Now, just to follow up from the previous story, because some of you were like, are we going to cover that? The boy is healed. The boy does receive healing, and the father goes along the way. And so Jesus takes the disciples. He talks to them later privately, and they're like, why couldn't we heal him? And he said, because this kind of spirit, this thing that was within him, it only comes out using prayer. Now, this is incredibly important because I think it illustrates a bigger truth and reality about God. Some of us view God as a transactional relationship. No one usually ever says that, but you can hear it in other language. That my relationship with God is I do this and I receive this. So the disciples, if they're in a transactional mindset, would say, I came and followed you. I gave you my allegiance, and then you transferred me the ability to heal. And I said the heal words, and it didn't happen. So you didn't hold up your end of the bargain, Jesus. We had a deal, no takebacks. And you hear this even in the Christian community today, where we think of God in this transactional way. I am a sinful, awful creature over here. You have the ability to forgive my sins. If I believe in your death and resurrection, and I say the prayer and I do the thing, I am no longer a sinner. I receive this thing. You died for me. I receive that, accept that, I believe that. I get into heaven. It's a transaction. It's punching a ticket. I think what Jesus is saying, he's like, you're thinking this in transactional terms. This is a relationship. You don't learn a system or a code. You don't learn the special incantation, the words to say, and then you have this ability. You stay in relationship with God. That's what it's about. I think it's a reflection of the way that all kinds of healing for the disciples and that work. And it's a good question for us to, do we consider God in transactional terms or do we consider God in relational terms? Do I come to know who God is? Do I make myself known in this space? And do I come to see myself truly for the first time in the presence of God? Yeah, that's the good stuff. That's the good stuff, not transactions. So now they get back on the road. They're walking, and Jesus says, hey, they're going to kill me, and 3 days later, I'm going to rise again. Now, I think the majority of the disciples that we talked about are in some kind of shame cycle. They had just thought they'd been able to heal. I think it actually would have felt really, really good if we get to some of our baser nature for the disciples if they hadn't been able to, if Jesus speaking hadn't been able to heal the Father's Son. Because then it'd be like, whew, it wasn't me. This is just like a real hard one. Even stumped Jesus. But when Jesus steps in and heals the boy, what's the problem? It's the disciples. They missed something. They didn't do it right. And so when you are in a shame cycle, when someone says something that you don't understand, you don't tend to raise your hand and be like, I didn't get that. You tend to just avoid it at all costs. I don't want to do that. Actually, this reminds me of something. Normally I do this wrong. I'm sharing this with you today because I did it right. That's how these things work. So last night I was waiting at an off-ramp and we were waiting for someone to go. And like I do at every off-ramp, I was looking at my phone for a bit because I'm awful. So I was doing that. And then I looked up and the light turned green and I was the third car back. And I was like, huh, it's weird. And like, I do this thing in my head, I don't know if you do, of like, when can I be a jerk and honk my horn? It's like 1-1,000, 2-1,000, not moving, this is weird, honk. And I didn't do like the honk, like I'm annoyed. You try to like get the pressure just right, it was like honk, it's like a suggestion, hey, honk. So as soon as I do the honk, I see that the reason why they're there is a homeless man who had been at the corner was receiving money from their door. The reason why the other car didn't honk is because you'd be a real jerk if you honked in that moment, right? And immediately as I see him go, I went, oh no, oh no, oh no. And my wife, who was sitting next to me, is like, you blew that one. Like, a little too much joy in her expression. So then it's like, oh gosh, like it's just the saddest driving forward. And you look at the guy and they're like, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. And then we pull up and immediately the three cars return. They're in the right lane, I'm in the left, and it's a red light at the next one. And my wife goes, I would stop in between those two cars if I were you, right? Like you don't want to line up next to the car that you just honked at. And I was like, no, we're going to take this one head on. So I lined up and I just immediately started like, I'm sorry, motioning at them. And the lady looks over at me and immediately gives me a, sorry we were helping someone, like thought I was still mad that they hadn't gone, rolled down the window. They rolled down their window. I'm like, I'm really sorry. I didn't see him. Like, I'm sorry. And rolled up the window, and Sally was giggling. She thought it was so funny. Usually what happens is we do something we're ashamed of, and what do we want to do? We want to park in between the cars. We want to avoid eye contact and just, come on, let's wrap this whole situation up, right? It's harder to lean into that. And I think the disciples are in a shame cycle that they couldn't heal. And Jesus said something they don't understand. And that's the last moment they want to raise their hand and say, I don't get it. Can you explain it to me? Because there's too much shame. It becomes blinding. And so you pretend that, yep, uh-huh, no, I totally get it. And what's the other manifestation of their shame? What's the conversation that we hear later that they are having? Like, yeah, Jesus, totally, die, 3 days later, we get it. And then they drop back and they're like, so who do you think's the best out of all of us, huh? Let's just go straight, 1 to 12. Who gets the number one spot, right? And I wonder if part of this isn't informed by 3 of the 12 disciples got to see the transfiguration while the other 9 disciples were failing. So I wonder who initiated this conversation. Yeah, you guys blew it. That was super embarrassing. You know what we were doing? Seeing the transfigured Christ. So I think that probably places solidly in the top 5. They were talking about who was the greatest amongst them. Here's another story, a conversation that I had this week. So one of the guys who goes for our church, Steve. Steve's a chaplain at OHSU. And we met this week, and he's been doing it for 2.5, 3 years. And so I love, like, everything you guys do for a living, I think is fascinating. It's like a different world. It's a different experience. And so I'm like, tell me about that. What have you learned? What's different now from 2.5 years ago to now? And his response was so insightful. He said, 2.5 years ago, I was so blinded by my own uncomfortability in the room with someone who is dying, with someone who's just had an impossible diagnosis. I was so self-absorbed, I didn't pick up anything. And he said, now when I walk in the room, I can actually be aware of the other people in the room. And I was like, yeah. You think when you walk into a new room or a new space, if you walked in here for the first time this morning, your first time doing something can be blinding. I don't know, if you walk into a busy restaurant or a busy space or a busy coffee shop, I work at a coffee shop during the week, so I do this a lot. When you walk in and it's busy, it's just like fight or flight is kicking in. Like, where do I go? What do I do? And I'll usually find myself at like this weird little corner, And like, it's uncomfortable. It looks weird, I'm sure, to everyone. And after I've been there about 5 minutes, I'm like, why am I not sitting at that big open table over there? Because I'm just trying to like escape the situation. I'm just trying to find the quickest, least awkward solution. I can't see the room yet because I'm blinded by me. But once we get over that, now we can see others. We can see ourselves. We can be present within the moment. I think this is the kind of thing that Jesus is going to be inviting them to next as he makes a point. Mark 9, 35 to 37. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12. Immediately after he knew, he's like, what were you guys talking about? They're like, nothing. He knew they were talking about being the greatest. He said, anyone who wants to be first must be very last and the servant of all. He took a little child whom he placed among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. A couple of things that are interesting. So the language that Jesus was very likely speaking and was written in this time was Aramaic. And what's interesting about Aramaic is there's this word, the same word to describe servant is the word for child. You just know in context, you're talking about a servant or a child, which also should tell you some things culturally about the role of children. The role of children in first century Jewish homes was to serve the male patriarch of the family. That was their role. That's what they did. Children didn't exist as people. And there's actually something where I think we miss some of this culturally here in our country because we have such a huge value for youth and vitality that we've kind of like children tend to, and not all spaces, but a lot of spaces have like this hyper importance and significance. But in this culture, they were a non-entity. Why? And this is why anytime you read this, a lot of times we read the Bible and the things of Jesus, and we're just looking for quotes to put on Instagram, right? With like maybe like a far-off mountain in the back view, like this thing. But all these quotes of Jesus come within context. There's things that are rolling from scene to scene that's informing why he's saying what he's saying in that moment. Why is he talking about children and service? Because it's about the fact that they were just arguing about who was being greatest, because they're just coming out of a shame cycle where they blew it, where they didn't, the majority of them didn't get it right. What's the invitation of Jesus? You are like children, so ashamed of being a child that you're trying to pretend like you're older, you're bigger, you're more important than you are, and you're so hurt and wounded by every failure that you have that it blinds you. You stop being present in the world, and you are putting so much emotional energy out there in the shields of your spacecraft to pretend to be more adult, more put together, more on top of it than you really are. And what's the invitation for Jesus? You don't have to live like that. You don't have to do that anymore. In this system, in this economy, children, servants have value. Everybody else is fighting and clawing to go this way. And guess where truth is found? Going this way. It's all about climbing and posturing and getting more powerful and more significant and more social or economic currency in this world. You want to be real big and real important. And what Jesus is saying is that's exhausting, that detracts from who God has created you to be, and truth is found over here. You don't have to keep pretending anymore. Because here's the thing about the perfect people among us. You're not. We're not. They're not here. But what is very alive and very true is our belief that there are perfect people sitting in this room or outside of this room. And it's hurtful and it's blinding and it robs from who God created you to be. You don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to live like that. Christ is inviting us to see past our own shame to see others. See past our own shame to see others. How do we show up and be aware of the world that we're in now? not the person who's scurrying into the crowded coffee shop and being so self-conscious that I'm the last one here, that we go over to this weird table that we don't need to go to. How do we just walk in and say, yep, I don't know. Yep, I'm not sure. Yep, I don't have it all together. Yep, all of those things are true already. We might as well acknowledge it. Yeah? You don't have it all put together. You're not perfect. You're kind of a mess on your best day. And guess what? That's okay. Some of you brush your teeth in the car on the way to work. That's okay. Some of you, like, don't get out of sweatpants until 2. That's okay. That's okay. Because a lot of times we want to take the details of our lives, our achievements, and the places where it looks like we have it right and point to that and say, that's who I am. And that is as true as pointing to your failures and saying, that's who I am. When Christ invites us to go the other way, he's saying neither of them are true. Look past that shame, look past that posturing, and find out who you truly are. Now, because this is called death's door, it's also an invitation to mourn. Mourn, the definition we're using, is to express sorrow or to express grief. Sorrow and grief. And one of the things I talked about earlier is a lot of times we feel like I only should feel sorrow and grief for the good things I don't have anymore. So if you lost a job you loved, if you lost a person in your life you loved, if you lost a relationship you had, if you had that car growing up and you made a mistake and sold it, that's an okay thing to grieve. What we have trouble grieving and feeling sorrow over is the bad things, the damaging things in our lives that we don't hold on to anymore. We feel guilty about grieving them because why would I grieve an abusive relationship? Why would I grieve or have sorrow for a dead end or a hurtful job? Why would I grieve or have sorrow for that person, that relationship, that thing that was really harmful or damaging to me? And the answer to why we grieve those things is because they're not there anymore. And we don't have to live under the power of that. To grieve and to mourn is to express sorrow, not for the loss of the good or the bad things. It's just to experience loss, that the situation has changed, that things are different. And why that's important is because I'm going to ask you to grieve something that Jesus just told us wasn't good. I think we need to ask ourselves, what does mourning, perfection, greatness, or adulting look like? You can put your own word. I put 3 words because none of them felt right, so I just went with all of them. You have your own definition of this. There's a kind of achievement. There's a kind of perfection. There's a kind of being something that we don't feel we are yet. There's a way of performing or doing things in every day that Jesus just said is not the goal. And what I'm saying is, yeah, it's not the goal, and you need to grieve it. You need to mourn it. You need to be aware that that's something that you are actively surrendering. Because otherwise, it's going to make it near impossible to think that being a servant or being a child is the goal or something to want. So, what does that look like for you? Maybe you need to wear black this week. Maybe you need to spill a little bit of cereal down your front every morning this week. I don't recommend it, but it's on the table, right? Maybe there's some kind of perfection, some kind of performance, some kind of appearance that the world has that you need to mourn and grieve so you can put it away. So you can walk away from it and say, not that anymore, but this. Being a servant, being a child, going the other direction, which gives us the freedom to show up to the life that we're living. So we're going to go into a time of prayer. And in that, there's going to be silence. This is going to be quiet. I didn't forget what to say next. That's for you to ask this question, to pray this question, say, God, what does mourning, what does grieving, what does letting go of perfection, whatever the thing is for you, performance, achievement, what does that look like in your life? Let's pray.